What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golliver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod Pina, who is covering these NBA finals for 538, GQ, and lots of other places online. Michael, we had a very interesting Game 3 comeback performance by the Miami Heat, taking that game, you know, avoiding the sweep, saving face, and all those good things. And Game 4 was super tense, super stressful. You could feel it in the building. I'm sure it came across on television. Everyone's yelling at the referees. Guys are going back and forth. Lots of people stepping up late in the game, whether it's KCP, Anthony Davis, Tyler Hero had some moments. Jimmy Butler's doing his thing. But I think the central takeaway from that game wound up being the Lakers' decision to shift Anthony Davis onto Jimmy Butler as a defensive strategy. Yahoo Sports has reported it was actually Anthony Davis's idea. I guess he was frustrated after watching Jimmy Butler score 40 points in Game 3. He wanted to have a chance to defend him. It wasn't like he erased Jimmy Butler from the planet, but certainly he was limiting Butler's offensive scoring effectiveness. Anthony Davis obviously was the runner-up for Defensive Player of the Year. He's a very versatile, very long defender. They always like to say he can guard 1 through 5, Michael, and you know, he showed a little bit of that in Game 4. I am curious more than anything, did you see this one coming? Because I love to try to guess the adjustments, you know, before they happen, or debate the adjustments before they happen. And I think I've just been in the bubble too long. Maybe my brain just kind of hit a wall and turned into mush. But I did not see this particular matchup adjustment coming. How about you?
Not to the degree that they used it, for sure. Especially being that this was Bam Adebayo's first game back from the neck injury. LeBron, I assume that they would just maybe switch up some of the coverages with LeBron particularly late, where he would, you know, they would hedge a little bit more on those screens when they were hunting Rondo and KCP, when the Heat were hunting those guys, instead of just kind of passively switching, particularly late in the game. But no, I did not see Anthony Davis assuming that responsibility, and I thought that it was smart. I mean, I think that Anthony Davis is the best defender in the world. No disrespect to Giannis, who is great. I think that Anthony Davis is slightly better, and I mean, he showed it. The fact that he can be that mobile on the perimeter, the fact that, you know, he was fighting through screens, the fact that you know, when Jimmy does not have the ball, you're kind of able to, you don't ignore him, obviously, but he's not the same exact type of threat in terms of someone spacing the floor. So he's Anthony Davis is also able to impact the paint a little bit. So yeah, it's a pretty brilliant move all in all.
For sure. Well, let's get back to that Giannis point here in a second. Let's start with what they would have seen on the tape from Game 3, because it would have been a lot of bodies just sprawled out, not able to handle Jimmy Butler's physicality going to the basket. And it's a story we've seen kind of repeat over and over. I mean, when Milwaukee was using smaller guys on him, he was able to kind of bulldoze there. He obviously is among the league leader in free throws this year. Jason Tatum had his moments on the wrong side of Jimmy Butler's physicality in the Eastern Conference Finals. I mean, go right down the list. I mean, Danny Green, KCP, any of the other guards just were not cutting it. And no. I think when they did try to use LeBron, you know, Jimmy's pretty crafty off the dribble. He's not the fastest player. He's not the quickest, but it did seem like LeBron maybe, you know, especially late in games, wasn't like having the best time there. So I'm sure that the Lakers coaches were kind of looking around and saying, like, what can we do to really stop this flow? And with Davis, you know, obviously I think the number one goal you have defending Butler is to kind of goad him into three-pointers, right? Just like back off of him. But you can't back off of him completely because he's a pretty capable mid-range jump shooter. He likes to get to that shot. He's really comfortable there. And he's been shooting it very well in the postseason. So there's this idea of like you can sucker him, but only to a certain degree. And you've got to have length to challenge those shots, basically. You know, if you're going to back off the threes, you still have to be able to challenge the mid-range. And then, of course, he wants to get to the basket, and length is going to be, you know, helpful there. You know, Davis just checks those boxes basically perfectly. Now, is he going to get beat off the dribble sometimes? But is there anybody better at recovering to block shots at the rim in the NBA right now than Anthony Davis? Is there anybody else in that conversation that you can think of? You know, I think Gobert – just because he's a little bit slower, tends to get beaten more, and he does, you know, have a pretty high quantity of block shots, you know, where he's able to recover back into a play because he's even longer than Davis. But it's a really unique skill set to be able to make that type of play. It's like a half-court chase down almost, if you want to look at it that way. And Davis just does a great job at it without fouling a lot of times. You know, I think usually bigs might get into guys' bodies when they try to do that, or they're stretching out too far, they lose control. But he's very adept at meeting layups at the rim after he's been beaten off the dribble. And you know, I think that's a real threat for LA's defense. It's something that he deploys actually when he's an off-ball defender too. But you add up all of these things, and he made Jimmy's night a lot more difficult than really any other Lakers defender had throughout this series.
AD is a terror. I mean, there's really no other way to put it. I mean, you talked about how he has this advantage where he's able to kind of sag off because of his arms and his wingspan and his closing speed. But, you know, one of the other things is, like, even when you want to give Jimmy the outside shot, what makes Miami so difficult to defend is what they'll do is they'll just run Duncan Robinson or Tyler Hero up for a dribble handoff, and then they'll be wide open for three. So you have to kind of respect Jimmy and any other ball handler, including Bam Adebayo, or Kelly Olynyk, when they have the ball on the perimeter and you're a big man. It makes it really difficult to defend those guys. But, I mean, AD is number one for me when it comes to the specific sequences that you're describing, where, you know, he gets beat off the bounce and then he needs to recover. His arms are just ridiculous, like, and he can jump out of the gym. So AD's there. I mean, I'll put Bam in that category, to be honest. I think Bam's closing speed and his physicality and his
intelligence and his timing. Well, he's got the explosive burst, right? I think Bam, when he recovers, it's a more explosive recovery, right? Whereas AD, he's just sort of like gliding smoothly through space to get there.
And AD feels inevitable. You know what I mean? Like, even after someone gets beat, there's just no, like, you expect the block, I think, which is not the case. Like, you're not amazed necessarily, or surprised, I should say. Whereas when most other guys come back and make a play like that at the rim, you're like, oh my goodness, that was incredible. With AD, it's like, that was expected. I expected this man to do this. He is the best defender in the world. At least that's what I think. So yeah, I mean, you know, I think if I was the Miami Heat, you know, I was a little bit surprised at their hesitancy to do what they did, I guess, to LeBron James at the end of Game 3 when Jimmy had so much success. I mean, I would expect more of that hunting that they did, where, you know, you bring Hero, you bring even Kendrick Nunn up to set screens and try to force switches. You know, it's easier said than done, and I'm sure that AD will be very active and, you know, dipping under those screens and still being able to recover, which is something that LeBron, you know, he could do, but I think that AD is just a different animal in this conversation. So, beyond that, I don't know what adjustments you make if you're Miami. It's just kind of like they need more out of the supporting cast. And this is where, you know, someone like Dragic would be humongous, because Dragic was the other, like, source of offensive engine for the Miami Heat. And not having him there, it really hurts when you take away the plan A.
That 8 years of age difference between LeBron and Anthony Davis really shows through. And also the fact that Davis has never won a ring before, that's where it shows through on the energy, on the perimeter switching and stepping out and fighting through screens and that kind of stuff. Because you could just do stuff at 27 that you can't do at 35, especially late in games in the fourth quarter. Like, LeBron knows what to do, right? LeBron's seen every coverage on both ends, but there's just a certain level of energy and hunger, I think, to Davis at this point. And, you know, it's a major characteristic of the Lakers defense as a whole. I mean, he's setting the tone for them, and they were very active. It was a grinding game for, like I said, very stressful. They were able to pull it out with, like, a big shot by KCP in the corner. Obviously, Davis hits the dagger. LeBron had a real tough and one coming back with his left hand. I mean, there were some nice offensive moments for the Lakers, but they definitely won game four, you know, kind of defense first. And it wasn't always pretty, although it is really fun to watch Davis do what he does. The reason why I wanted to talk about, you know, this adjustment and whether we saw it coming and all of that, maybe we should have seen this coming, right? Because didn't we get a preview all the way back in the second round where Jimmy's going absolutely nuts in the fourth quarter against the Milwaukee Bucks? And there's this question postgame directly to Giannis. Did you ask for the defensive responsibility on Jimmy Butler? You're the presumptive at that point defensive player of the year. This guy's lighting you up. He's overwhelming your smaller guards. He's getting to his spot against your wings. Giannis has some length. Giannis is, you know, obviously also in this category of kind of a 1-to-5 defender, supposedly able to guard every position. Is he as ideally equipped to defend Jimmy Butler as Anthony Davis? You can make a strong argument that no, he's not, because Davis, I think, moves a little bit better and is longer. But at the same time, you can make a strong argument that you want to put your best defensive player on the best defensive team in the league on the opposing player's star in that moment. And, you know, some stars would say, I want that responsibility, like Anthony Davis did, before game four. So this all just kind of begs the question. I mean, is this another example or further evidence of Milwaukee's sort of coaching blunders or strategic blunders or refusal to adapt and adjust within a series? Because I just find it very hard to believe that Frank Vogel and Anthony Davis would have ever had a meeting like the Bucks, where it's like, nope, we're going to stick to our plan. We're going down with it, right? Let's just go ahead and not adjust anything when Jimmy Butler's going nuts. Had they taken that same approach in game four, they probably lose game four, right?
I didn't know that Rich Paul was my co-host today. I'm stunned. I you come in at Giannis like this. I did not expect it.
No. I'm frustrated on Giannis's behalf because I just think that, like, good playoff coaching, you've got to be adaptable. We've talked about it a million times, right? Nick Nurse, Eric Spoelstra, these guys are, reacting in some cases possession to possession. And it just feels like Coach Bud's out there saying, no, we're just going to do it our way or the highway. Let's just see what happens. And, as you're seeing, here's counter evidence. What happens if you put your best defensive player on Jimmy Butler, who is a sensational offensive force, but he's not the best player in the league, right? So if you're meeting strength with strength, you have a real chance to win that. And Milwaukee got absolutely blitzed by Jimmy in the moments that mattered in that series.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is an interesting... My brain actually never even went back to that comparison, but it is a fascinating one.
Well, it's my brain is stuck on Coach Mike Budenholzer and the fact
I
that
know it is.
He's holding Giannis back, and this is just really clear evidence of the fact. Look, the best defense, by the way, for Coach Bud is that if Giannis did take on that responsibility, he would get into foul trouble and more quickly and easily than Anthony Davis. And we saw the impact of what happens if Anthony Davis gets into foul trouble in game three, right? The Lakers look terrible. Everybody looks terrible. And then that's why they lost that game primarily to me, was because he couldn't stay on the court and he just never caught a rhythm. So it's not like as black and white obvious of a strategic decision as I'm painting it. But I do think, especially, going back to that second round series, when Butler's just going absolutely nuts in the fourth quarter, it's just a natural inclination for your best player to say, all right, it's time for me to do my best here to shut it down.
No, I totally get where you're coming from and what you're saying. I also think that, the Lakers could have won this game if they never made that adjustment. And even with that adjustment, they were still, the Miami Heat were still, so close to winning this game and probably still should have, one could say. I mean, I know we're going to talk about some things that could have gone, some bounces of the balls that could have gone either way. This was just such a close game. And a couple shots go in either way, the Miami Heat could have won. So it was, I think we look at this adjustment and we kind of need an answer to why the Lakers won this game. I still, it's just really frustrating if you're a Miami Heat fan. And I think it could just be as simple as, again, Kendrick Nunn is playing however many minutes Nunn played.
It's a brutal loss for Miami. I mean, because they played so well and so hard in game three. They got the game of Jimmy's life in game three. And you come back with full force. You're definitely overmatched. You're shorthanded. Bam's playing kind of heroically after missing time, right? And you're right there. And then it's just, as Spoelstra said, you know, basically the Lakers just made a couple more things. The game was in the balance. It was there for the tanking, and the Lakers just did it, and the Heat didn't. What were some of those moments for you? Which ones stood out? Were there particular sequences or a shot here and there that you feel like were the pivot points for this game?
I think there was one watching it live where I just knew that the Lakers were going to win after it happened. It was with a little over 3 minutes to go. Lakers were up two. LeBron was actually defending Jimmy at this point. Jimmy dribbles into a wide open corner three, and LeBron actually doesn't even close out. He kind of just gives him the shot. I don't know if that was because of exhaustion or if that was if that was strategic thinking. But Jimmy misses it.
Yeah, strategic thinking by a 35-year-old, right? In the fourth quarter.
Exactly. LeBron grabs the miss, just like bull rushes in transition, finds KCP in the right corner. KCP makes the three over a Tyler Hero closeout. I thought that that was, you know, that was it's like the swing there is so late in a game that was going back and forth, where if Jimmy hits that three, Miami goes up one. Miami is able to then set up their defense, and it's just a whole different final 3 minutes, I think.
Oh, no question. Forward. No, that one was huge. Just monster shot by KCP in that particular moment. And, you know, he's been working on that, you know, run out, get to the spot, get your feed set, quick trigger type shot all season long. That's like one of his main responsibilities, and he absolutely delivered when it mattered. I think that that play from LeBron illustrated his impact throughout the second half of this game, especially later into this game, because I just want to underscore this. Like, the Lakers were very, very close to fraying, right? They were feeling the pressure big time. Even in the empty gym, you can just hear all the headlines. Are they going to blow the 2-0 lead? Now it's 2-2. They've got Bam back. All the momentum goes back the other direction if Miami wins that game, right? The Lakers could feel it. I mean, look, they have been the favorites the whole way. There is legitimate pressure on LeBron basically every moment. I think he told everybody after that game it felt like one of the biggest games of his life coming in. And maybe he's laying it on a little thick there. But no, at the same time, like, I mean, the internet will melt if the Lakers lost this series, right? I mean, it really would. There would be a backlash for sure. So
that is an understatement, my friend.
Right. So that's why I give him a little pass on that superlative comment from him, because, you know, he understands what he has to be in the middle of the backlash. I mean, that would be not fun, right? So especially when you've made it this far after 3 months in the bubble and everything else. So there was a couple moments like Kuzma throws a pass away. Jimmy takes it the other way in transition. LeBron is just pissed, right? But he's able to kind of like pull himself together. Next possession down, he actually trusts Kuzma with the kick out corner three, same spot as the KCP three. He goes right back to him. He hits a shot. I thought that was a big moment.
Can I pause you real quick after that? Because that play, Rondo went over to LeBron after Kuzma made that mistake and was talking to him and like trying to calm him down. And I think that that was, you know, going back to an article that I read about Rondo and how last season when LeBron was, you know, he would get very upset at the young guys, Lonzo and Ingram. This was pre-AD. And Rondo would go to LeBron, and whenever LeBron would use poor body language to express frustration with the youngsters, Rondo would be like, yo, you have to instill confidence in these guys because they look up to you. And Kuzma was one of those players. And I you know, I don't know for a fact that Rondo was saying something to that something like that to LeBron in that spot about Kuzma, but it wasn't totally shocking to me that LeBron then went right back to him and he hit that shot.
That all adds up to me, because LeBron was so mad at Kuzma, and it made my eyes wide when he went right back to him on that very next play, because I've just seen him not do that many times during his career, right? When he's frustrated at somebody and just make different decisions, either put it on his own shoulders or just go a different direction. And it was a very crucial moment. There was another one where LeBron is super pissed off at Caruso for a defensive breakdown, and he decides, okay, my response to this on the offensive end is to go get that tough lefty and one layup. And I think he followed that up with like five straight free throws where he's just kind of doing bully ball on the offensive glass and all this stuff, where again, they were right there ready to freak out and fray, you know, and, you know, lots of finger pointing and talking and everything else. And, you know, LeBron was going hard on everybody. Like, if I'm Rondo, maybe I go over to Zach Zarba and John Goble, try to build up their confidence after this performance, because he was really, really pissed off throughout this entire game. I've never seen a player that I can remember, and maybe it's because we can actually hear everything in the bubble, and it's just nonstop lobbying from LeBron on these officials. So, I agree with your KCP3 as one of those big moments. I would also say that Kuzma decision and that lefty layup kind of lumped those together. I think that would be another one to me that was kind of a pivot point. Which other pivot points did you see?
I mean, honestly, like, and this is very general, but it goes and speaks to an advantage that the Lakers have had this entire series. Just their ability on the offensive rebound and their aggressiveness on the offensive glass, where they send guys, they send Rondo, they send Caruso, they send Danny Green, they send KCP into the paint to try to create second chance opportunities instead of retreating back to set up the defense on the other end. And it's just like really paid off for them. And it's such a backbreaker whenever you get a stop against the Los Angeles Lakers, where AD misses a shot or LeBron settles for a three because he's exhausted and it bricks, and then Rondo comes in out of nowhere and gets the rebound, and then they're able to set up their offense again. So that happened multiple times in game four.
For sure.
Just a devastating effect.
Great point. I mean, some of LeBron's free throws came off the offensive glass where he's scrapping with, you know, like Jimmy or Bam or someone like that. Look, their small lineup is still big, right? I mean, that's one big takeaway here, is like, even when they take their center off the court, if you have AD and LeBron as your 5-4 and, you know, you're going against Bam, Jimmy in those matchups, you're bigger, longer, stronger at both spots, and their wings are pretty darn big too. So we definitely saw that come through. Any last pivot points before we move on?
Basically every KCP basket. Like, I just want to real quick.
Oh,
like,
now who's Rich Paul? Come on, Michael.
No. Like, I'm sorry, but, you know, I was looking through the timeline, as one does throughout game four, and particularly after we kind of knew who was going to win in the last 90 or so seconds. And, like, I don't know. Like, KCP was in his role, right? And he hit some threes. Like, that's basically my takeaway from KCP's performance. 15 points, 5 assists, which were nice, no doubt. That's really not what he normally does. But the adulation that came and like, the flowers that were being thrown in KCP's direction, like, I didn't really agree with the extent of the praise on him, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Look, if Marcus Smart buries that three in front of the bench and then goes through and has that crazy layup through traffic, I mean, you're building him a statue, Michael. So come on now.
How dare you compare Marcus Smart with KCP? Wow.
I know. One's about to be a champion. There's a big difference. You're right. No, let's go back to this adjustment just for 1 minute, because sure. I always get into this adjustments. I mean, when you're doing the finals analysis, and we're doing multiple podcasts a week during these finals, as I've done for years, it always drives so much of the conversation. This one, it caught me by surprise a little bit, as I mentioned, and it just got me thinking, like, what are the all-time best finals adjustments that we can remember or our favorites? I think the most obvious one that people point to would be like the Andre Iguodala into the starting lineup. I mean, that decision got multiple stories. You know, who came up with it in the video room, and it was pitched to Steve Kerr, and, you know, that adjustment wound up basically changing the NBA for like the next 4 years straight, right? Now all of a sudden it's small ball and spacing and all that, and centers are going obsolete. So that was a very, very big one, and it was more offense-oriented than anything. This Davis one was more defense-oriented. There was actually one the year before, which I particularly enjoyed, when the Spurs, who were basically playing two centers with Tim Duncan and Tiago Splitter in 2014, which seems insane to think about now, right? They take Splitter off for Boris Diaw, and all of a sudden they have this beautiful offense. Everything's wide open. You know, they get like 70 points and a half. They just seem like completely overwhelming against the Miami Heat, and that winds up, you know, pretty much ending that series early. I've always had a soft spot for that adjustment. Do you have other favorites or all-time adjustments that stick out when you see something like Davis on Jimmy and everyone's going nuts about it? Where does your mind go?
I mean, when I first read this question on the outline, my head went to Iguodala first and foremost, you know, starting in game 4, I think, and then they cruise for the rest of that series.
His nickname should be The Adjustment. What do you think? Real
that's,
catchy.
That's a pretty... I like that, though. That's not bad. I know he hates
you
Iggy.
You would like yeah. that. The dorkiest possible thing I could come up with is the only time you agree. I love it.
But then right after that, 2011 finals, Rick Carlisle starting J.J. Barea in, I believe it was game 4 also. And then... I think like what is so fascinating about that adjustment by Rick Carlisle was that up until that point, like J.J. Barea wasn't playing particularly great. Like he had 2 points in game 1, 5 points in game 2. Oh,
I feel like he was a punchline before this adjustment, right? I mean, like I think there were some people who respected like what he could do, but wasn't he kind of a joke? Like people just kind of like, you know, laughed at him in a certain way. I don't want to be too rude here because obviously he's had an incredible career. I'm more trying to capture the mood before that adjustment, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit out of left field, like from my memory, just trying to, because like, you know, he's the smallest guy on both teams. It felt slightly desperate almost. I mean, he was really problematic for the Miami Heat, just his pick and roll game, like one thing about him that was very underrated, and I guess he's still playing, so still is underrated, but the way that, you know, LeBron would try to back him down in that series, I remember, and he drew like 2 or 3 key fouls where he just like, you could call it a flop, but like he's so good at that, to feint like you are getting abused when no one is really even touching you yet. Like I really appreciated that about him, but he was just so slippery after that. And after he was inserted into the starting lineup, you know, Dallas didn't lose another game in that series and Miami really didn't have an answer for it. So I thought that's like a pretty big one to me. I don't know if they win that series, if Rick Carlisle does not make such an, like, not obvious adjustment while down in the series.
Totally agree. It's a great one. I also feel like it changed the trajectory of his entire career, right? Like, now he is the guy who kind of bamboozled LeBron. Like, you know, his presence on the court, like, kind of, like, threw the Heat for a loop. And, like, you know, he's the little David against the Goliath of the Heatles, right? I just think, yeah, it's hard to explain exactly how he was treated before that. But I do feel like that Mavericks team in general was underrated by basically everyone, including myself, heading into that. Dirk was not taken nearly as seriously or nearly as respected as he is after he won that title. People were just, you know, he was a fun guy to pick on. Everyone wanted to call him soft and he couldn't do in the playoffs. And, you know, he's a one-way player and all that stuff. I think all of their role players were also like individually underrated across the board. I think, you know, 2020 NBA analysis would look at Sean Marion and get it, right? I'm not sure 2010, 2011 NBA analysis really got it, right? You know, Jason Kidd, I think, was still a little bit polarizing at that point. Obviously respected, but, you know, never had quite done it. I mean, you just kind of go down the list. You know, Jason Terry, is he just a loudmouth or can he actually deliver? Like, there was a lot of different guys. I mean, Deshaun Stevenson, that's his own category, right? With his goofy t-shirts
Legend.
And all that stuff. Right, but I think that Barea almost symbolizes all of that better than anyone because he's like the smallest package and came up the biggest in terms of impact in ways that we didn't expect. So absolutely great adjustment. I want to read this question from Anton, Michael. He says, I've heard commentary about the 3-1 comebacks this year being possibly related to the weirdness of the bubble and that it wouldn't necessarily happen in a normal season. But I actually think the Cleveland Cavaliers 3-1 comeback in the 2016 finals showed teams that it's possible to do it, and therefore it leads to other teams not packing it in and actually keep trying in those situations. As amateur psychologists, what do you think of my theory? It's a great question from Anton in Barcelona. Michael, he signed it with love, so we give, you know, love right back to our friends in Spain. Here's the thing, Anton. Imagine the scene of this NBA Finals. if Game 5 is happening at Staples Center after a 10-year title drought for the Lakers. They're coming back home up 3-1. They're wearing those black Kobe Bryant Mamba jerseys. Rihanna is in the crowd courtside. She's not skipping out on the virtual fan session like she did during Game 4, absolutely breaking my heart by doing that. Jack Nicholson's going crazy. Every celebrity in town is paying $50,000 to sit courtside for this game. I mean, you know, the list goes on and on and on what type of an environment would be. Mm-hmm. Miami's not walking in there and winning Game 5. I'm sorry. That's just not going to happen, especially with LeBron's record in closeout games, especially with Anthony Davis, you know, one win from his first title, especially with the prospect of being able to go out and party in Hollywood all night after you win, right? It's just there's no possible way the Lakers are losing that game. You talk about the weirdness of the bubble. They definitely could lose Game 5. It's an empty gym. They've already lost Game 3. There's a formula for Miami to do it. The margins are not very big, but there's a possibility that they're able to kind of pull this thing off. And, you know, it's a challenging environment. Like even things like LeBron's son turning 16, right? Or LeBron tweeting that he can't sleep. And all these different kinds of things are just different than what you would normally expect during the finals. And so I think it does open up some opportunity or a bigger possibility just by being on that neutral site court and just by hoping that somebody like Tyler Hero, who's been getting wide open shots all series long, catches fire like he does against Boston, right? I mean, there are ways for Miami to kind of manufacture a win here. Now, are they going to pull off a 3-1 comeback? No, I would guess not. But I think that they're chances of doing it, being able to play games 5 and 7 on a neutral site as compared to the Lakers home court, I would say it's like 10% or 10 times better rather, right? Like I might give them, you know, a 1% chance of doing that in a normal environment. I would say they got a 10% chance to do it right now. That seems like reasonable odds.
I would say it's even higher than that, but also obviously if we were to spread this hypothetical out, you know, the Denver Nuggets do not beat the Los Angeles Clippers in the second. I mean, like, yeah, you know, you could go
totally.
On and on.
No, I agree. If the Clippers had played games 5 and 7 at home in that series, they win, right? They probably win in 5, honestly.
Sure. Yeah. No, 100%. So there's obviously that. But I mean, I give Miami, I might just be, you know, super naive / foolish, but I give them a higher winning percentage or odds or whatever you want to say.
Put a number on it. Put a number on it, Michael.
I don't have a number. I mean, I've honestly, since game one, actually probably game two, I would not have called a coin flip either. But with Bam back and them kind of, in Miami kind of settling into what their rotation is without Dragic and getting more comfortable with that, I do think that these games are a lot closer in terms of, you know, who can win and how Miami is playing and, like, strategically.
Well, real quick here, if all games are coin flips, right, 5, 6, and 7, if those are coin flips in the bubble, I think that gives Miami like a 12.5% chance of doing this, coming back from a 3-1. So that's not too far off by 10%. But would you give them even? Are you willing to go stronger than that?
I failed math miserably in just about every grade.
Right. So yeah, look,
I have no idea what's going on right now.
I'm pretty sure that's correct. I think if you do 1/2 to the 3rd, you're going to get 1/8. I'm pretty sure that's how that works. But
I believe you. I believe you. I don't know. Like, I don't think Miami's going to come back and win. I should say that right off the top. But like, you just watch how these two teams are playing, and you watch how specifically Miami's defense, what they are doing to LA's offense. Like, they're forcing these threes. They're limiting opportunities in the paint. I have a stat for you. 46% of LA's shots in this series have been threes. Coming into this series, that number was 35%. Only 40% of LA's shots have been in the paint in this series. Coming in, that number was 50. So, like, Miami is doing a terrific job of limiting transition opportunities, forcing the shots that they want LA to take. You know, Markieff Morris is taking a bunch of shots. Caruso, KCP made them pay, but those are the shots that, you know, contested threes, either above the break or from the corner. That's what Miami wants. They do not want LeBron just kind of sashaying his way into the paint and finishing as he can basically still do regardless, but not as often. So I look at that and I see a team that is executing their game plan really well. And, you know, minus the flurry that we saw in the fourth quarter of game four from the 3-point line by Miami, they shot the three ball like really bad in the first three quarters, uncharacteristically so. So, like, I don't know. Like, you get a couple guys get hot. Hero gets hot. Duncan Robinson gets hot early on. They build a little bit of a lead. They have Bam. Bam's going to play more minutes. Like, you could easily just talk me into them winning the next two games, honestly.
You could definitely talk me into them winning game five. It has been a very tight series, especially since the last two games. And I'm glad to see it, you know, because I was really frustrated and a little bit down with how Miami played in the first two games. It felt like we were getting this letdown. And to me, even if they lose in five, I won't remember this finals as a letdown. I will remember it just kind of having some twists and turns and, okay, you know, the Lakers experience and the Lakers top end talent, and they just get just enough in the supporting cast and they go ahead and win the title. I'm not saying I'm going to remember it the most fondly of any final series I've covered. Actually, it would probably be in the, you know, the lower 10 or 20%. Yeah, you know, it's in the conversation for the worst, but it's a lot better than the sweep would have been, and that's why I want to give Miami credit there. Let's shift gears here a little bit, because I could hear something in your voice, Michael, when I mentioned LeBron's comment about this being one of the biggest games of his career. You did that dismissive chuckle that the Open Floor Glow members can always hear from you. What gives? Are you taking shots here at LeBron or what?
I just strongly disagree that, like, game four with your team up 2-1, I understand that, you know, it would have been 2-2 and whatever, but, like, it was, every finals game's big, but this man has played in two game sevens in the NBA finals. You know, game six of the Eastern Conference Finals against the Celtics in 2012 in Boston was a do or die for his legacy and how he, like, the conversation of whether or not he could be the greatest player who ever lived. If he loses that game, he plays poorly in that game and it's over. There's, like, no more questions to be asked. The player empowerment era probably doesn't take off in the way it did. I mean, that was a humongous fork in the road moment of his career, and in my opinion, the most important game and the biggest game and the biggest performance by him. But, like, I would even go back to game two of the 2012 finals, where they're down 0-1 to the Oklahoma City Thunder. He has that, like, phantom no-call foul against KD in game two. Do you remember that? Where no whistles called. He's got his hand on him. It was a clear foul. They barely win that game.
I got a ride home that night from Royce Young. He was kind enough to be my host, took me back to my hotel, and I could just sense all of Oklahoma's heartbreak on that ride home. You know, that was just a tough end game.
Yeah, so, I mean, that game, I feel like that was, I don't want to say any game two is a must win, but if the Heat lost that game and they went down 0-2 like that, I think it would have been very difficult. Particularly, we're going back to a point in LeBron's career where he had not ever won the championship. So the pressure was just humongous.
Point taken here. Let's quantify this. I mean, not a top 10 game, top 20. Where are you putting this one? Because there were stakes, right? And look, if I'm going to defend LeBron, the idea is, like, this bubble sucks. It's time to go home. If they lose game four, it's probably going seven, right? And that's pretty dicey. And you're giving Miami that confidence that they thrive on. And you're facing an absolute storm of questions and takes and all these other things. He's clearly... as I mentioned, I mean, it seemed to me like the pressure was getting to all these guys. You know, they were right on the verge of cracking there at times during game four. So I think that maybe some of his comments is being made out of relief. At the same time, I also think that he's falling victim to this idea of the superlatives, which, you know, is just running amok in our society right now. Like, even watching the vice presidential debate last night, they open it by calling it the most important vice presidential debate in the history of our country. Can we fact check that claim, please? And then the main takeaway from the debate is that a fly landed on Mike Pence's head, and we're already moving off of this debate 12 hours later, right? So are we completely sure that was the most important vice presidential debate in the history of our country. Probably not, right? We just fall victim to these kinds of these exaggerations or these superlatives. And LeBron's been doing it a lot, frankly. He's called the bubble run the most challenging of his career, right? The biggest test. And in some cases, I'm inclined to give him a pass because his bubble is really tough. You know, it's mm-hmm. no joke. And I think that's where he's coming from when he puts that biggest game label. It's this idea of, you know, the finish line is right in sight, and it would be such a mental test to have lost that game and have to kind of regroup after having such a commanding 2-0 lead. But I also agree with your point, which is if you've had a career as long and distinguished as LeBron's, it's really kind of a tough sell here. So how many games do you think just roughly have been bigger than that one? 20?
20. I don't know. I mean, I'd have to, as you said, I'd have to fact check, and I'd have to go dig in the crates and try to figure out a specific answer for you. But maybe, you know, trying to get into LeBron's head for 2 seconds, like, maybe he felt this way in terms of it being the biggest game of his career because those previous examples, he was at his physical prime. And, you know, if he were to fall down, not game six, obviously, because that was an elimination game in the conference finals, but like his ability to overcome just athletically. And like, I say this as someone who's just like, you know, he did not look like he had it. He did not look like he had lift in that game through certain segments in ways that you just don't see from LeBron James.
Michael, he told us that the turnovers were the problem after game three when he had 8, and he came out and had 5 in the first half of game 4.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, he hasn't been at his best, and I think this whole situation might be wearing on him. That's totally fair. So from that perspective, sure, you know, I'm sure he thinks that it was a humongous game. But while we're speaking in superlatives, can I quickly throw in that this is also the easiest run in terms of competition that he's ever faced going to the finals? Is that okay to say?
I thought you were going to call me the best podcaster you've ever come across. I was getting excited there when you started saying that.
well, I know that would be, that's not a superlative. That's just a fact, Ben.
Oh, brilliant. Well done. Thank you. Thank you, Michael. It's, mm-hmm. it feels so nice to be in such prestigious company. Well, here's the thing. I saw your column on this easiest thing, and I got to push back, Michael. Come on. I mean, we're stuck in this bubble. You know, neither one of us has seen Bronny in 3 months. You know, it's heartbreaking. Come on.
Uh-huh. Yeah, sure. I know you agree with that take. I know deep down you do.
Well, here's first of all, if you're just going to say, like, how many games did it take? How much did they win by? How much did they kind of control the action? Did he have the talent advantage over the opponents? Yeah. How many future Hall of Famers did he have to play? I mean, I think all of those things, you know, from a strictly basketball sense, are yeah. true, because LeBron's been the underdog. He's usually been in the Eastern Conference playing against dynasties from the Western Conference, the much mm-hmm. stronger and more accomplished conference of the two. Never forget it, Michael. So I think from that standpoint, there's some validity to what you're saying. The other point I'd make is that LeBron has never had a teammate have as good of a postseason run as Anthony Davis has had this year. The big okay. debate coming into this season was AD versus Kyrie versus Dwayne Wade. Who's the best sidekick? I will still go Wade because he's a more accomplished overall player. I think that's his title to hang on to for a while here, and AD might eventually eclipse him. But if you're saying which of LeBron's teammates has had a better showing start to finish through the playoffs, it's Anthony Davis by a mile. I think the only people who have had better player efficiency ratings than AD at this point during a playoff run with at least 15 games are LeBron, Jordan, and prime Shaq. That's the whole list. And that includes his weaker games offensively in games 3 and 4 of the finals. Mm-hmm. You look at his other metrics, true shooting percentage, you've pointed that out. He's way up there with, you know, like peak Kevin Durant. The win shares per 48 number, he's super high on that because he's just contributing in so many different ways. And the clearest example of how good Anthony Davis has been is that he's actually in a finals MVP debate with LeBron. And if they wind up winning this thing in 5, and there's never been a situation in LeBron's career where there was ever a debate about finals MVP when they were winning the title. The debates have come in when he was so good that he's on the losing team getting himself into conversations about does he deserve it over Andre Iguodala. But there's never been a situation where people were like, you know what, actually, you know, Dwayne Wade or Chris Bosh, they really deserve it. Maybe we should give it to Ray Allen for that shot in the corner. Like, that was never a thing. And certainly even when Kyrie's going off in 2016, he never entered that equation either. So that's why
Can I ask you a quick question? Because you said that Wade was, you'll take Wade as his best teammate ever, right? In 2011, let's say that this is a tough hypothetical, but let's say the Miami Heat win that series. Like, Wade was really good in that series. Do you think that it never really got to the point where we were talking seriously about Finals MVP, but do you think that Wade would have won Finals MVP over LeBron in that series?
It's a great hypothetical. I do think he would. I believe that was his best statistical playoff run of any with LeBron.
No question.
It's really hard to look the other way on a couple of those performances from LeBron late in that series, right? And I also think you still had the narrative juice of it kind of being Wade's team, right? And LeBron was still the new guy, so you probably could have gotten away with it. I think by that 2011-2012 season, LeBron was just the guy, right? That was sort of the turning point of like, hey, this is his league, MVP, Finals MVP, first title. And it was just sort of an overwhelming thing. LeBron hadn't quite settled out into that role in the previous year. So I do think that Wade would have won the Finals MVP had they won that title.
Fascinating. I think that AD is his best teammate ever. Not even close. And I'm not forgetting or discounting the amazing finals performance that Kyrie Irving had in 2016.
Kyrie's not even in this conversation.
No, he's really not. No, he's not.
Well, so what's the case? Are you making a case like in a vacuum, like pure talent? Because, you know, Wade, he's got a lot of accomplishments and AD's only 27, right? He's got a ways to go too. I mean, we could say that AD will eventually retire as a more accomplished player than Wade, but it feels like you're selling short the old guy here, you know, the Heatle.
I all respect to Dwayne Wade. I think he's a great player, one of the best three or four shooting guards ever, probably, right? I think that AD, I think AD will have a better career, honestly. Like, the fact that he hasn't even really reached his peak yet and he's already just irrepressible on both ends of the court. And the fact that we're even having a discussion, as old as LeBron is still remarkable on the court. Like, he's been incredible throughout this entire playoff run. And, his statistics are through the roof in this series, even with the struggles that we've been discussing. The fact that we're even having a conversation about one of his teammates as the Finals MVP, and I personally think AD is the Finals MVP, and I think he's also the most talented and more important, maybe not more important. I don't even know what I'm talking about anymore. But I think that the fact that we're having this conversation about better player on the Lakers right now is just a testament to AD and how, like, just absurd he is as a basketball player. And we spent the first 20 minutes or so of this podcast talking about the big adjustment that the Lakers made, right? And that adjustment was take LeBron off of the other team's best player, put AD on, and success.
Yeah, I think you should have said voila there, but I agree. I mean, that was it's a great way to underscore AD's value. The only argument I would say, and I would still have LeBron as Finals MVP, mm-hmm. I just think everything they do offensively looks completely different without LeBron. I think AD's offensive efficiency plummets if LeBron's not on the court and you just have a typical point guard over the course of an entire game. I think that the Lakers' role players' flaws would show through so much that you would just be in a situation where if AD's their best guy offensively, it's really frustrating. And, they're just hoping to win just an absolutely ugly series. And, you know, can they get by defensively if they're playing a center when they don't have Anthony Davis? I mean, it's possible. You know, is LeBron just able to orchestrate the game still at a high enough level that he can get it done? I think the real lesson is, you know, Miami would have a great chance, you know, if one of those two superstars was gone for LA. It's not that they're shallow, their bench is like super weak, or that their, you know, supporting guys are terrible. It's just that those two main guys have both been so good consistently throughout this postseason that's driving so much of the success for what they do.
Real quick, I have another hypothetical for you that just kind of sprung into my head. I hope this isn't disrespectful, but I know that it'll be taken that way.
Bring it on.
Do you think that if the roles were reversed and, you know, we're saying just for the sake of this discussion that, let's say that, you know, in the same manner that Bam Adebayo injured himself and was unable to play in game two and more importantly, game three, where Jimmy Butler had that performance, do we think if the roles were reversed and Anthony Davis was unable to play that LeBron would have a performance like Jimmy Butler's in him at this point?
I think so. And there's a decent chance he breaks it out in game five. it's possible. I mean, look, he's hit some pretty high levels here during this postseason. I know there's people who are going to nitpick his numbers, and I do think he's been pacing himself quite a bit. And he doesn't have the lift at moments. We've definitely seen that. I agree with it. He's had to scrap for his points and his contributions in ways that we're not accustomed to. He's not the same guy physically as he was in the 2018 finals. Not even close, right? There's a clear difference. But it's more about the mind. It's more about the control. It's more about the orchestration. He can just do things that Butler can't do, and really nobody else can do. You know, speaking of Butler, I wanted to ask you another quick question before we start to close up here. We got a very funny hypothetical question that came in from Owen. He writes, I had a thought. Would Jimmy Butler have been able to make it work with Jim Boylan as his coach in Chicago? We know Jimmy loves to work hard. He would have loved running suicides and doing push-ups in practice. I doubt that they win a title, but the Bulls may have missed a chance at a match made in heaven. Love the work you guys are doing. Keep it up. Thanks, Owen, for that email and this hypothetical. It's very funny, Michael, in hindsight, because they went from Thibodeau, you know, a very tough-minded coach, to Hoiberg, like the least tough-minded, most player-friendly coach you're ever going to see, back to Jim Boylan, this tough-minded, you know, hard-nosed coach. Have you ever seen that with your friends in their relationships? You know, maybe they date someone who likes to party, and then they switch it up and date someone who's maybe more of a bookworm, and then they switch it back up because they don't like that, and they go back to the party person. They just swing wildly from pole to pole. I've definitely seen that happen, you know, from my friends, and that's exactly what the Bulls did here. It makes even less sense in hindsight. I'm not convinced that Jimmy could make it work with Jim Boylan. What do you think?
It's either we're living on two sides of the extreme, right? Like either it works great and they love each other and they compliment each other after every game to the media and the Bulls make the playoffs and maybe win a playoff series. Who knows? They're competitive. They know who they are. Or Jimmy is arrested for second-degree homicide. Those are like those are the two possibilities, in my opinion.
Oh, boy. He's joking, everyone. He's joking. Well, here's the thing. Jimmy would like this idea of accountability. The punch clock, Jimmy's into punch clocks. He would be the person who'd said, I want to have the earliest time on my punch clock, right? I think the problem is there was something missing from Boylan, whether it's an internal credibility, whether it's a lack of head coaching experience, whether it was a communication ability, whatever it was, his attempts at accountability never connected with those other players, right? So I think Jimmy would be open to that message. But if you have a coach who's selling something that people aren't buying, that will turn every star player off immediately, right? You go back to that David Black situation in Cleveland. Like, he had a great track record. A lot of people spoke very glowingly of him. Ultimately, he was trying to pitch stuff that LeBron and some of those other players in Cleveland weren't trying to hear, and it was just a matter of time before he was out of there, right? Like, he never really built himself up that way. And I think that, in hindsight, the Bulls' young players were actually pretty charitable in their treatment of Jim Boylan, even though some shots were fired at various points along the way or subtly kind of subtweets along the way. Like, they never really came out and roasted him completely. You know that the private group chats were a lot harsher than what came out publicly. And I think just in Jimmy's situation, like, you know, we know how confrontational and how much of a straight shooter he is. If those kinds of feelings were bubbling below the surface, Jimmy's bringing them to the surface, right? And so I just think it wouldn't have been a match made in heaven. I'll say that.
Yeah. I mean, you say that some things were kind of like the statements weren't as volatile as you would think in public as they would have been in private, but actions also speak louder than words. And there was a near mutiny and there was a leadership council was assembled. So I think that, you know, we've rehashed this a million times. It was a total disaster. And I don't know if Jimmy... Jimmy thrives on chaos, so we talked about it in the last episode, and he thrives on confrontation and all that, but I think this would have been too much for him to navigate.
I'm picturing Jimmy wearing one of those United Nations headsets that they offer to the delegates, sitting at the leadership council, you know, like really weighing in thoughtfully on some real, you know, important conversations, like how many wind sprints are we going to run and everything else. I just think this is more of a Jim Boylan thing than a Jimmy personality thing. You know, I think ultimately he will not get another chance at a head coaching job because there was just something missing there in terms of how he was connecting with players. And you just never know if guys have that credibility or not. I mean, Tibbs has definitely been able to mold players in different spots into his way of thinking, even though he's incredibly hard-nosed and traditional. There's been some other coaches who have had success with that approach. Spoelstra is an amazing example of that. It's pretty wild how demanding he is of his players, especially when it comes to defensive responsibilities, and the fact that they respond to it is incredible, and they have for so long. That style of coaching these days is not for everybody, and not everyone can pull it off. I just don't see that being a match. All right, Michael, a lighthearted question to close comes in from Jacob. He says, I understand as a devoted Open Floor member, I'm a bit biased, but Michael the Pod Pina is one of the best writers in the game today. More superlatives, Michael. Michael's thorough analysis, interesting interviews, creative ideas, and emphasis on social justice more than make up for the occasional style pieces that he does for GQ. But this dude needs to step up his butterfly knowledge. The annual monarch butterfly migration in North America is one of the coolest natural phenomenons in the world. Each fall, thousands of monarch butterflies head south for the winter, some traveling as far as 3,000 miles. Mexican folklore explains the monarchs as beloved ancestors returning just in time for Dia de los Muertos, which is similar to Halloween. Think of the monarchs like an annual migration of top free agents to the Western Conference or power forwards to the New York Knicks. Incredible analogies from Jacob. I'm glad he buttered you up a little bit before, you know, ruthlessly tearing down your butterfly knowledge. Michael, what do you have to say for yourself?
I love this email from Jacob for a variety of reasons. I like learning things. I'm dumbfounded that butterflies can fly 3,000 miles. That is another thing that I did not know before reading this email. So shout out to Jacob. I bet, Ben, that you did not know any of this either, regardless of what you have to say for yourself. So Jacob knows more about butterflies than you, and that's all I have to say about it.
Look, first of all, I knew that butterflies migrated. I absolutely knew that. I suspected that they had gone south for warmer weather when I made my comment on the last podcast about there not being as many butterflies. That was like a 50-50 guess. I mean, it was north or south, right? I knew that they went that on that kind of a path. And I was pretty confident that they went south for the winter, and so I'm glad to be validated. I just want to point out and put this, on your mental landscape, Michael. I use the Calm app and Headspace for meditation, and it's been very helpful for me here over these last couple of years. The Calm app actually has like a 20-minute long discussion and explanation of the monarch butterfly migration in its sleep section. So they've got a very nice kind of ASMR type voice reading to you about the monarch butterfly migrations, actually on the West Coast is where they're focused. But, just in case you do want to learn more and at the same time you want to get to bed a little bit earlier, Michael, let me recommend that to you and all of our listeners.
I'm speechless. First of all, that's amazing.
Thank you.
I'm speechless right now.
Okay, well, be sure to check it out. We'll wait to hear back from you. You sound really, really interested. All right, Michael. I think we've reached the end of another episode of Open Floor. Thanks for that awesome email, Jacob. You made both of us laugh the other night when we saw that one. Guys, check us out on Apple Podcasts by searching for Open Floor. That's two words. When you find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. Don't want to guilt trip you guys, but I've been stuck in a bubble for 3 months. I think we're up over 2,100 reviews, Michael. So if these listeners have not reviewed us, can you please do me a solid? Show me a little thank you for all these days here at Disney World, and go ahead and give us that 5-star review and write some kind words. We would really appreciate it. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golliver, on Twitter at Ben Golliver. Be sure to check out my Washington Post newsletter. Sign up for that on my Twitter page. Michael is on Twitter and Instagram at Michael V as in Victor Pina. As Jacob pointed out, Michael's been doing phenomenal work, all sorts of interesting interviews with different voices around the basketball universe. Be sure to check those out at GQ and 538. All right, Michael, until next week when we may be back to discuss the end of the NBA Finals and the possibility of an offseason, I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben. Yeah.